It seems obvious the problems of global climate change are caused by the same fossil fuels that are about to peak. The BC Sustainable Energy Association argues that if we tackle the challenge of peak oil and gas, we will simultaneously tackle global warming, and vice versa. They say this energy crisis points to the need for BC's cities and regions to design and then develop a future based on sustainable energy. Last month, that organization produced a report called Sustainable Energy Solutions for BC that proposes radical change in our energy industries and economy. They say that 400,000 jobs could be created over 25 years from sustainable energy initiatives. We are joined now by Guy Dauncey, the president of the BC Sustainable Energy Association. Thank you again for joining us, Guy.
Thanks, Sam.
So what are the sustainable technologies areas with the most potential to create new sources of energy?
In British Columbia, we have a huge energy capacity for wind energy. We have a very big tidal energy capacity. We have a large microhydro capacity. We have great lot of potential we could have by just being much more efficient, by not using energy in the first place, just by using more efficient appliances, which frees up energy. And there's several other sources of energy as well.
And how did you come up with the projection that you've made that 400,000 jobs could be created by moving toward green power technologies?
Well, what you have to do for this is you take each of the sectors. So you take wind energy, for instance, and then there's data. You know that there's an average of 6.25 jobs per megawatt, of which six are in the manufacturing and installation and one in planning, and so it goes on. And then you analyze this different formula for microhydro, for geothermal energy, for tidal energy, for solar electricity, for efficiency and for solar hot water. So it's not one standard formula, because I mean, some things like energy efficiency, for instance, you've got to have someone crawling around in everyone's attic, you know, increasing the amount of insulation, making the windows more efficient, draft-proofing the homes. So that's very labor-intensive. So there's quite a high jobs formula for that one. In fact, to reach the energy efficiency potential, which is to save about a quarter of all the energy we use at the moment, would generate around 145,000 jobs over a 20-30-year period. So that's a very big number.
You had mentioned tidal power. That's a source we don't really hear that much about, and it's listed in the report as being one source with a lot of potential to produce energy. How well developed is that technology?
Well, there's two kinds of tidal energy. There's a kind that's up and running in the world already in one or two places, where you basically take a big river and the tide comes in the river and you have a wall across it, and then when the tide comes out of the river, it passes through a dam like a hydro seam. We don't support that technology at all, and no one's building them anymore, because it destroys the tidal estuary system, which is packed full of marine life. So when we talk about tidal energy, what you've got to picture is wind turbines sitting on the bottom of the ocean in an area where the tide goes back and forward, say in a narrows. And the tides it's lunar energy. I mean, the tides are pulled by the gravitational pull of the moon and the sun combined. And so the water's going back and forward. When it goes one way, the turbines turn one way, then it goes the other way, they turn the other way. Now, anyone who's been up and down our coast, especially from, you know, once you pass Campbell River and start heading north, there are so many inlets and channels that the water is rushing up those inlets and then rushing out again. So there's really fabulous tidal potential. The big limiting factor is, of course, you've got to bring that energy into the grid. So you've got to, if you have to sort of, you know, lay in 100 miles of electricity cables in order to, and pylons and everything, to get the power, then it becomes ridiculously expensive. So you need to find locations that are close to the grid. But even with that kind of study, it looks like, you know, we've got, you know, over 2,000 megawatts of potential tidal energy. Let's put that in perspective. We use around 11,000 megawatts for our power needs in British Columbia at the moment. So there are three tidal systems in the world in the water at the moment. There's one off the coast of Devon in England, one off the northern coast of Norway up in the Arctic, and one, would you believe, off Victoria, right down here on southern Vancouver Island, where Pearson College have been given the guardianship on some little islands called Race Rocks, where there's a lighthouse, and they have a marine station out there where they go and do marine ecology work. But it's powered by diesel, so every twice a year they're taking diesel across in a barge, and that's a very dodgy business, because the diesel's spilt, and it's the sea lions gathering there and lots of sea life. So they're putting in a tidal turbine under the water down there to provide power for their ecology center and for the lighthouse. Yep.
And what role does transportation play in the approach that you're trying to promote?
Well, it's quite intriguing because our report was about our electricity supplies. And so basically we British Columbia, to put this in perspective, British Columbia uses around 55,000 gigawatt hours of electricity. And we've shown there's an additional 84,000 gigawatt hours on top of everything we're using at the moment through energy efficiency and sustainable energy potentials. Now, when I first spoke to BC Hydro about all this, their attitude was, well, you know, transport and oil, that's not our department. We don't need to worry ourselves about that. And I said, well, wait a minute. If you look just how efficient electric vehicles are, and you realize that you can run, if you take a little car like the smart car, and you had that on electric, it's going to cost you, you know, $7 a month to run that car. Now, a lot of people, with, you know, every time you fill up the tank, it's $30, $40, $50. And that price of $7 will be really firm and stable. Now, and on top of that, there's some people in California who are taking the car called the Prius, the hybrid gas-electric car. They're adding extra electric batteries at the front to make it a plug-in hybrid electric, which you can plug it into the grid at night to recharge it. So now suddenly we're looking at the future potential of using a lot of electricity to run our vehicle fleet when the oil is gone or when the oil is too expensive to use, which is actually coming up remarkably soon. Because what I believe, I can't prove this, but I believe along with a lot of other people, that we're now in the second half of the world's oil supply, which means the price will, every year on now, get more and more expensive. So then when you look, if you assume that every single vehicle in British Columbia is going to use electricity, I analyzed all the numbers based on what we know of how much electricity it takes to run the average car, and it came out to around 8,000 gigawatt hours that we need if the whole fleet was run on electricity. And I just, earlier in the report, we found that we have 84,000 gigawatt hours. So one-tenth of our full potential would be sufficient to run our whole transport fleet, which is, even if I'm wrong by a factor of two, I mean, we've still got lots of energy available for doing all our transport when the oil is gone. So that's actually really encouraging, because other people are freaking out that when the oil is gone, the whole world's going to collapse.
And what do these issues of efficiency and conservation mean in terms of job production, job creation?
For vehicles, I haven't a clue. We just haven't been able to analyze the jobs for the whole vehicle, the transportation revolution. For electricity itself, there's a lot of jobs. If you think of every house, you know, needing to have an upgrade, so that it wastes less power. If the total comes to 145,000 jobs over a 30-year period in efficiency, it comes to sort of about $37 for every $1 million that are invested. Whereas if you're investing in coal or gas, it's only 7 jobs. So instead of 7 jobs for coal or gas energy, it's 37 jobs by getting your energy through efficiency. And also, it's much cheaper to get it through efficiency as well. So it's a much more sensible way to go than building a new coal-fired power plant or anything stupid like that.
The report also recommends taking an integrated approach rather than focusing on a few sort of silver bullet solutions. Can you talk about what that integrated approach would look like?
Well, you have to, when you're looking at renewable forms of energy, they're what's called intermittent. So if you put in solar energy and you have solar voltaic cells on the roof of your house, when the sun's not shining, you're not getting much electricity. And if you put up wind turbines and you have a beautiful, you know, month in the summer when there's no wind, there's no electricity. So you have to balance all these sources together so you can have microhydro and wind and tidal energy and solar electricity all operating at the same time, or rather different versions of the same time. And now, to wrap your mind around this, the traditional idea of a grid is that one big power plant, you know, produces power all the time by burning coal or burning gas and shoving it down the grid to everyone else. The future grid is what's called a distributed grid or a smart grid, when you've got, you know, a million different sources of electricity being generated. I mean, every single rooftop in British Columbia will end up generating solar electricity within, I'd say, 20 to 30 years. We'll be behind the world because our price of electricity is so very cheap that there's less incentive for people to invest in the new technologies. The solar revolution is being driven by the Japanese, the Germans, and coming up right now, the Californians. And they will actually do the legwork for us. They will shoulder the burden of reducing the price of solar energy so that we can all afford to do it. So integrating it all together means having a smart grid with real-time electronics that ties it into one effective system.
You recommend also that the phrase public interest, as it's currently interpreted by the BC Utilities Commission, be reinterpreted. How should that change?
Well, this is a really big factor. It seems very small, but BC Hydro is regulated by the BC Utilities Commission. And the province has taken a very hands-off approach to energy policy. There really is no energy policy in British Columbia, apart from pump more oil and pump more gas. And if, to the extent there is one, the province says, oh, just make sure the electricity is cheap. And the BC Utilities Commission has a legal mandate to serve the public interest. Now, they interpret that to mean that all the public wants is cheap power. And on the surface of things, that sounds very good. But if you stop and think about it, cheap power means there's much less incentive for us to think about efficiency. It means there's much less incentive to get new technologies into the system, such as wind energy and solar energy and tidal energy like that. And it also means we're back of the pack in the whole of North America in developing these technologies and the jobs that go with them. So we believe that the public interest also needs to think about how do we prepare for a future when the energy security from oil and gas is constrained, or whether we just can't depend on it, and as it's running out, a future when we really have to address global climate change. I just spent a week in Montreal at the big global climate change conference, and I can tell you there was among the people there a real sense of concern about what the science is telling us. It's very alarming, and we really need to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions very seriously. And so that's in the public interest as well. Otherwise, there's chaos erupting around the world. We've got New Orleans happening all over the place all the time.
Despite those concerns that have been raised recently in Montreal and elsewhere, BC in the meantime is aggressively promoting technologies like coal bed methane and other fossil fuel solutions. What kind of pressure do you think it'll take to actually change that focus?
Well, public pressure. You're quite right. I mean, I use the phrase, if BC Hydro tries to go ahead with a coal-fired power plant, they'll have what's called a P4 response. And P4 stands for prolonged and persistent public protest. Because everyone knows that burning coal belongs in the 19th century. It's just not something we should be doing at the moment. And coal bed methane is equally bad. It's also a fossil fuel. The methane is like natural gas. And it uses lots of fresh water from rivers you've got to pump underground to get it out, and it's messy and dirty, and we just don't need to do that. But the present government is very, I would say, generally speaking, most of the members of the government have no sympathies for things like wind energy and tidal energy. Barry Penner, the Ministry of Environment, is one exception to that. And we're hoping that the task force that he's been co-chairing will come up with some very, good suggestions for the ways in which we can accelerate what's called smart energy or sustainable energy or renewable energy. But otherwise, it's a matter of how many lobbyists are there at the gate. I mean, there's a lot of constant lobbying from the coal industry. They've got shareholders. They can make money from it all. And they're up against the public, who we don't make money from stopping it. We just make money from, we get a feeling of public service by trying to protect the public benefit. And that's why we have to oppose coal firepower and oppose coal bed methane. It's tough to oppose the increased, drilling for oil and gas, but really they're harmful to the planet as well.
And how can people get involved in supporting the use of sustainable energy?
Well, we launched the BC Sustainable Energy Association a year and a half ago, specifically to allow people who are excited about these things to have a place to get together. So literally, you can become a member of the BCSEA. Our website is www.bcsea.org. Our membership is $35 for a family or an individual, and $10 if you're a student or on low income. And if you're a business, it's $100 plus a little bit for each employee. We have over 650 members in a year and a half, and we got 50 businesses included in that. And we got so many activities going on, the list would take forever to tell you. We got very active chapters in Victoria and Vancouver, and also smaller chapters in Kamloops and Kelowna and Prince George and Nanaimo. So what we've discovered, a lot of our members are really young. They just want to, they see there's a future in this. They believe, look, come on, guys, the future is not going to be coal and gas and even nuclear. The future is tidal, wind, electric vehicles, smart cars, biodiesel, all this kind of stuff. And they're getting involved and making things happen. So we really welcome people to join the BCSEA and join us, because we need to build a strong voice to get to the government and say, look, no to coal and no to more fossil fuels and yes to a sustainable energy future.
Well, thank you for speaking with us this morning, Guy.
My pleasure. Thanks very much, Lisa.
I've been speaking with Guy Dauncey, the president of the BC Sustainable Energy Association. He's the author of the book Stormy Weather, 101 Solutions to Global Climate Change. The Sustainable Energy Solutions for BC report can be found on the BCSEA website, which is bcsea.org. You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.